Prepare to be astonished.
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening and welcome to an adventure in history. I'm Alana Quila with Providence Seaside Hospital, here this evening with Mac Burns, Executive Director of the Clatsop County Historical Society.
It's just us.
It is.
And you know, I failed miserably. I didn't print out KMUN pledge time.
Ooh, it's happening.
And if listeners want to continue to listen to the brilliance that is Alana and Matt,
yes,
you should contribute because KMUN is wonderful.
And it is.
Beyond our radio show, there are many fine programs.
And they have a great podcast format. If you haven't been there, if you go to their website and look at podcast, we're right up at the top, which is nice.
That's why we called it what it is.
But you can scroll down and listen anytime, and there is a wide variety of programs.
If you miss your favorite show, you can just click and listen.
There's some good ones. Food programs.
It's a nonprofit. It's worth your writing a check. So write a check for like $50. Write a check for $100 and send it in.
That's it.
It's easy peasy.
And you can donate online too.
You can. Or you can put a check in the mail or do it online or give it to a friend to drop off.
Find one of us. Yes.
There you go.
Lots of ways. We are very appreciative for sure to be on KMUN.
We are.
Yes.
This is where we fit. It would be strange if it was just you and me sitting here talking for no reason without mics.
It would, yes. Interviewing people.
And having people come in and sit here for no...
Because then, we'd still do it.
Yeah, but it would be weird.
It would be, yeah.
So there you go. Yeah. Go to the KMUN's website and make a big fat donation and say it was because Alana Mack told you to.
Yes.
All right. And I should have been better prepared, but I was not.
Oh,
It's been a crazy couple of months.
It has.
It's been a crazy couple of years. So
yes.
I apologize. I'm not better prepared.
We can do it.
So shall we get right to the big show?
Yeah.
Because you know, and also last week.
This date in history? Do you have this date in history?
We do. Last week's guest was so power-packed with energy.
Yes.
It like feels like a vacuum of energy now without her here and just the two of us.
I know. Which is why if you haven't caught her show, you can go back on that podcast
and
listen.
All right. So these are things that happened tomorrow, September 27th, 1066.
Ooh.
I know.
You like that one.
I don't go back. Because I admit I am selfishly just interested in American history. 1066, William the Conqueror's troops set sail from Normandy to conquest of England.
Ooh.
I just like somebody naming themselves William the Conqueror.
Yeah, it's a great name.
It kind of sends the message. He's not coming with his hands out.
Although, did history rewrite his name?
Possibly.
Likely.
1779, John Adams is appointed to negotiate peace terms with the British. I wonder how that worked out. I like this one. 1892, book matches are patented by the Diamond Match Company.
Oh.
Now you can just have those little. See, I kind of hate those though. I hate trying to light them because sometimes they like burn my finger.
Oh well, yeah. But before they had the electronic ones, right?
See, I hate those too.
Oh.
I like the box of matches and that wooden match striking it along the side. There's something very satisfying about that. All right, 1905, the physics journal Annalen der Physik published Albert Einstein's paper. Does the inertia of a body depend upon its energy content? It introduces the equation E equals MC squared.
That's great.
Let's see, 1937. This was almost my favorite. The first Santa Claus training school opens.
Oh.
It's in Albion, New York.
I love that.
I do too. 1937. And I want to know who proposed it.
Yeah.
And how many students did they have that first year?
And what did they charge?
And exactly. I mean, there's just so much more to that I want to know. So I might have to do some more research. 1940, the tripartite pact is signed by Germany, Italy, and Japan.
That was good.
The Axis powers. Mm-hmm. So not good.
Well,
what?
Right. Yes.
I was going to say, wait a minute. Are you disagree?
That was a good moment in history.
1954, The Tonight Show first premieres on NBC, hosted by Steve Allen.
Oh.
We always forget that there was hosts before Johnny Carson.
Right.
1991, My Own Private Idaho premieres. It's a Gus Van Sant film, so Gus Van Sant makes a lot of films in Oregon, so we like everything he does. But our history highlight of the day, the thing I think had the most impact on history, 1908, Henry Ford's first Model T automobile leaves the plant in Detroit, Michigan.
Wow.
The Model T.
That is big. That's a good one. But you missed one. Now, one I definitely thought you would have. 1920, eight Chicago White Sox players are charged with fixing the 1919 World Series.
Ooh, one of the best baseball movies ever made, too, by John Sayles.
Ooh.
Eight Men Out.
Yeah.
It's pretty well done.
And then in 1964, the Warren Commission, investigating the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, issues its report stating its conclusion that Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole gunman.
The sole gunman.
I don't know.
Maybe not. We don't know.
So I was just in Dallas a couple months ago, and I visited that area. And it's very small.
It is.
It was disorienting how small it was. And my thought was, really, of all the places, this seems like you have such a short amount of time to accomplish your task of killing this person.
Yes.
This is not ideal.
No. And they talk about the what a long shot it was, and I'm not a gun person, so I don't really know, is this an amazing sniper shot or what? I get moving target is harder, but it also seems like you had such a short window road curves, and there's an overpass.
There's an overpass, yeah.
But it also doesn't seem like it's all that far.
No. And he was
almost
to that overpass.
Yeah, yeah. Just another half a second or something.
Which is where that other theory comes in, that a second shooter would truly have been under the overpass.
Yes.
All they would have had to have done is turn around and walk away. And there's train tracks.
Into
you're
the
on
crowd.
The other side of...
Have I told you about my lack of filter when I visited the Book Depository museum, the sixth floor museum?
Yes, no.
I was there by myself on some, I think I was at a museum conference or something, and I'm standing in line, so I don't have friends ahead of me or behind me to snicker and make inappropriate comments to, but there's a metal detector. And when I see that we're all going through a metal detector, the first thing that pops in my head, I said, isn't that a little late? And the people around me did not appreciate that at all.
I can
nor should they. But it is kind of late. I mean, why didn't they put it in earlier?
Yes, because it was a book depository.
So anyway,
there's a whole other show there.
There is. Well, speaking of other shows, you know, a couple of weeks ago we talked about the Gold Rush and an historian that went up to the Alaskan Gold Rush, and somebody was quizzing me, and I did not have information. They were talking about the food.
Okay.
So I did a little prospecting of my own.
All right.
So today we're going to present Foods Prospectors 8 to Survive in the Gold Rush. And this is not just the Alaskan Gold Rush.
Okay.
The 19th century was a time of great expansion and growth for the American empire, so to speak. And the first major gold rush began when the naturally occurring element was discovered in Sutter's Mill, California in 1848, less than 2 weeks before America won the so-called Mexican-American War, opening up the western edges of the continent. Nearly 100,000 people, known as 49ers, flocked to the Sierra Nevada mountains over the next 2 years. The entrepreneurial spirit brought on by gold mining survived until the end of the century, when the next great gold rush across arose in the Yukon Territory, covering southern Alaska and western Canada. That's the one we talked about on the air here. After gold was found in the Klondike River in 1896, the Klondike Gold Rush began the next year, bringing 100,000 potential miners called Stampeders. I'd rather be called a Stampeder than a 49er. into the treacherous, frigid region. North Carolina and the Pacific Northwest were forever changed by these gold rushes, from population increases to economic growth to the introduction of new foods. People from all over the country, even all over the world, were crammed together in overcrowded camps and settlements, mixing ideas and recipes. Supplies were often limited, and food rations had to last much longer than normal, especially in remote regions. Resourceful gold miners knew how to pack accordingly for long journeys, except for our guy that we talked about.
I know.
That he thought he was just going to hunt and catch fish. And they knew how to use the resources around them. So we put together some foodstuffs that they had.
Ooh, so we'll start with the poppy seed potato bread made with a sourdough starter. The evolution of poppy seed potato bread is a tale that spans territories and generations. It started during the California Gold Rush, when miners developed an alternative to yeast that would allow them to make softer and fluffier breads, sourdough. According to writer Ed Wood, a true sourdough is nothing more than flour and water with wild yeast to make it rise and special bacteria to provide the flavor. Adding sugar to flour and water also does the trick, and keeping the concoction warm allows it to ferment. Breads made with this unique mixture, called a sourdough starter, became a San Francisco standard as folks flocked from the mountains into the city to spread news of their findings, including their new favorite foods. San Francisco developed its own sourdough breads, noted for their tangier flavor profiles. Miners in California developed sourdough starters because manufactured yeast was hard to come by, especially as people moved farther away from settlements. Prospectors during the Klondike Gold Rush also relied on sourdough starters to make bread. In both the nether regions of Alaska and California, miners kept their starters alive and heated by keeping them close to their bodies.
Ew.
That sounds disgusting.
Yeah, I don't want any part of that.
Potatoes came into the bread-making mix during the Klondike Gold Rush because the starchy vegetables were more plentiful than flour in the Yukon. Miners added poppy seeds for an extra crunch, and poppy seed potato bread was born.
I'm not into poppy seeds. I don't think they add anything.
Yeah, I'm not either. Okay. But sourdough, I mean, in San Francisco sourdough, you just go right down to their waterfront, right? And you can smell their bread making.
There you go. And, you know, all the people that were making sourdough during COVID here?
Yeah.
They were just reenactors, apparently.
Yeah, you're right.
We were
right.
Just reenacting the California Gold Rush.
You're right. We couldn't buy. I forgot about that. I did have to have a friend get yeast for me because I couldn't get yeast for bread.
Didn't everybody try and right. do sourdough? All right. So I get the sad, gross one here. Ugh. Galapagos tortoise liver. Ugh. Doesn't that sound appetizing?
Yeah, it's delicious.
I can't find it in any restaurants locally. California's population boomed during its gold rush. Importers saw it as a chance to capitalize off an exotic trade item, intercontinental turtles. From sea turtles to Galapagos tortoises, the San Francisco markets went crazy for these reptiles. In 1849, at least 122 Galapagos tortoises were sent to the San Francisco Bay Area. The number was over 500 in 1855. Butchering the mammoth tortoises was no easy task, but their parts were used in everything, pies, soups, and baked goods. Turtle steak, which also sounds disgusting, was also a common dish, but many partakers believed the liver was the most delectable. As one captain wrote in his diary, turtle liver was far superior to any kind of meat I ever ate. Galapagos tortoise numbers declined dramatically as a result of their inclusion in Bay Area menus as the California Gold Rush ended and San Francisco prepared itself for the burgeoning industrial era. Interest in eating turtles declined too, thank goodness.
I did have turtle soup before when I lived in Florida, because in Florida you can eat anything, right? I mean, really.
Okay.
And it's just like anything. Right? I mean, it's kind of like almost like a clam texture,
ew.
Very little taste. So,
the only terrible. Thing I like about the idea of eating turtles is that it comes in its own bowl.
Oh, that's terrible. Moving on. Kelp relish. The first commercially preserved foods in America were distributed around the time of the California Gold Rush, but food preservation methods had been around for centuries. In the Yukon, miners and explorers started making their own versions of a preserved food enjoyed by native Alaskans long before their lands were encroached upon. Kelp relish. Still a common relish ingredient in Alaska, as well as Asia, kelp is a larger type of seaweed that grows up and down the state's coast. While harvesting kelp can be daunting, using preservation methods to keep it fresh for longer periods of time gave miners the freedom to travel a long distance with a ready supply of relish. A basic ingredient list for kelp relish involves salt water, onion, lemon, pickling spice, brown sugar, vinegar, and of course, kelp.
Okay, are you eating kelp relish?
No.
See, me neither.
But seaweed, a lot of people eat seaweed.
Yeah, not me.
That's kind of a delicacy.
I get it. But all right, Hangtown Fry. Hangtown, California got its name from a series of hangings that occurred there, but the name is now affiliated more with food than public executions.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. Associated with public hangings? As the story goes, a miner struck gold in Hangtown, now known as Placerville. At the height of the California Gold Rush, the first thing he did was run to the nearest saloon and request the most expensive meal they offered. What the cook prepared was a massive omelet with bacon and oysters, which satiated the miner so well that the dish spread and gained its own moniker, Hangtown Fry. Recipes and variations of Hangtown Fry abound, and I suspect that's a lot of legend more than
right.
fact.
Sounds like a good story, though.
Yeah. So bacon and oysters in an omelet. I'm not excited by the oysters in an omelet.
Oh, Mark loves Hangtown Fry.
Separate, okay. But
not in it.
Yeah.
It would go well with your turtle soup. Devil's Club. The Devil's Club, a plant that also goes by the nickname Alaskan ginseng is a tough and thorny shrub that grows from the Yukon all the way to the California coast. It grows tall and dense and can be a pain to harvest. During the Klondike Gold Rush, the Devil's Club was used as a spice, but it only worked if the leaves were plucked when they were young and under 2 inches long. In Anne Chenaday's Gold Rush Grub, from turpentine stew to huchinu, flavor variations of the plant get a vivid description. Nibbled raw, the buds taste like intensely herbal celery leaves. Cooked, they are reminiscent of the edible bases of artichoke leaves.
I think I'm okay with that one.
Yeah, that sounds like a good one.
I would give that a shot. Yeah. Moose pie.
Okay.
I'm going to already say I'm okay with moose pie, I think. moose were huge, of course, in the Great Alaskan Wilderness during the Klondike Gold Rush, so it's easy to imagine why the large mammals became prime game for miners. While some would eat moose meat, as others took it to the next level, making savory moose pies. One recipe calls for moose steak, another calls for ground moose meat. Potatoes and onions were often added to the pies for filling and flavor.
Makes sense.
I'm down with that, yeah.
Salmon stew. Seafood was a staple for lucky miners, and Pacific salmon was a fatty treat for those who came across it. Stews and soups bring ingredients together before they spoil in a filling meal that can last for a few days.
See, I get the stew lasts longer, but I kind of feel like you're ruining the salmon by throwing it in a stew.
I know, right?
It feels a little sacrilegious. All right, hardtack. Hardtack is about as flavorful as it sounds, composed of only two ingredients, flour and water. Hardtack was the mass-produced snack of the military that became popular among miners for being cheap and easy to make. Essentially dry, stale crackers, hardtack was prevalent during gold rush times, a testament to the fact that it wasn't all glitz and glamour for gold miners. In fact, most of them lived in dirty camps with little to eat. If they were lucky, they could add some salt to their hardtack.
Ugh. That sounds awful.
You know, I've seen reenactors going to like some Civil War reenactment camps and things like that. And I've been to a couple of mountain man rendezvous. I've seen the hardtack, but I've never actually tasted it. I kind of want to like experiment, make some and see what it tastes like because I have a feeling it'd be horrible.
It's very similar to the recipe I use for making Play-Doh.
Well, when I was in kindergarten, I liked eating Play-Doh.
There you go. I'm probably not going to get the name of this correct, but I think it's Mirror Eggs. Just off the coast of San Francisco, the Farallon Islands were home to large populations of seabirds during the California Gold Rush. As food supplies diminished due to population boom, adventurous businessmen traveled to the Farallons in search of profitable protein source, eggs. Egg poaching became a dangerous but trendy endeavor. There are really no shores where you can land a small boat except with great perils, said Mary Jane Schramm of the Farallons National Marine Sanctuary. After a San Francisco pharmacist started boating out to the islands and selling these eggs in the city, the egg rush officially began. Eggs of the muir, a bird that resembles a penguin, were favored because they were twice the size of chicken eggs. In 1851, the Pacific Egg Company was founded. It's estimated that 500,000 muir eggs were poached each year, which had a catastrophic effect on the bird's population. Once the proliferation of chicken farms was able to satisfy the egg craze, they were left alone. Today, the muir rookeries are thriving.
Okay, there's so many things in that I love. I love the egg rush.
Yeah.
And I just want to superimpose instead of gold rush, I want to superimpose all these miners looking for eggs.
Eggs, yeah.
That just makes me happy, that image. And then I love the Pacific Egg Company. I don't know why. I just love the name of that.
Yeah.
The Pacific Egg Company. So, all right. Dried apples. Once prospectors made the exhausting journey all the way to California, the food available to them in camps was not much different from the minimal rations they carried with them. While they were fed tales about the riches awaiting them, what they found instead were long, tiring hours of work and little nourishing food. As one miner wrote, they were left with hard bread, which we eat half-cooked, and salt pork, with occasionally a salmon, which we purchase off the Native Americans. Vegetables are not to be procured. Typical fare in the camps included dried apples, which lasted much longer than fresh fruit. Dried apples were hated by miners, and one of them even took to poetry to articulate his disdain. I loathe, abhor, detest, despise, abominate dried apple pies. I like good bread, I like good meat, or anything that's good to eat. But of all the poor grub beneath the skies, the poorest is dried apple pies. Give me toothaches or sore eyes in preference to such kind of pies.
I love that.
That's amazing. That guy didn't become the National Poet Laureate.
Didn't like to eat his fruits and vegetables. English monkey is a dish that made its way to the California gold mines during the gold rush, a testament to the diverse backgrounds and food preferences of those who made it out of the West. English monkey, which is Welsh originally, is also known as Welsh rabbit. It's theorized that the poor Welsh people came up with this dish and the English gave it the name Welsh rabbit as an insult. It contains no rabbit, actually no meat at all, but it is a sauce-like mixture of breadcrumbs, cheese, milk, and eggs. English monkey is meant to be poured over bread or crackers. 1897's Practical Vegetarian Cookery contains a traditional English monkey recipe. Soak one cupful of breadcrumbs in one cupful of milk for about 10 or 15 minutes. Melt one tablespoon of butter, add one cupful of cheese broken into small pieces, stir until melted. Add the crumbs and one beaten egg, one half teaspoon of salt, a few grains of bicarbonate of soda, as large as a pea. Cook for 5 minutes, serve on wafers.
Suddenly we're a cooking show.
Yeah, there we go. It doesn't sound so terrible.
I'm not digging that it's false advertising, though.
I know.
There's no monkeys or rabbits in this thing.
That's a strange name.
All right, Cornish pasties. Cornish pasties are another traditional food brought over from England during the California Gold Rush. People traveled all the way from Cornwall, England, to get rich, bringing with them one of their favorite treats. According to one report, the stereotypical idea of a mine was a hole in the ground with a Cornish male standing at the bottom eating a Cornish pasty. Those pasties are basically meat and potatoes inside a pastry shell, and they have remained a prominent fixture of the mining town Grass Valley, California, to this day. And we actually have a food truck.
I was going to say, on the west end of Astoria, you can get the same thing.
And they're good.
They are so good. We buy them frozen.
Ooh.
And then you cook them in the oven whenever you want.
I haven't done that.
Oh, it's so nice.
I should think about that. The gravy is also to die for. Whew, oh, my goodness.
You know, I missed out on the gravy. That was something you had to ask for.
Yes.
So I didn't know.
Yeah. I don't know if it's extra or you just have to ask for it. But
I don't know. Yeah.
But they're good. Hand pies.
Yes.
Yummy.
Roasted bighorn sheep. Something I won't be ordering here locally. Colorado experienced its own gold rush, the Pike's Peak Gold Rush, from 1858 to 1860. Miners were forced to adapt to the harsh, high-altitude conditions as well as severely cold winters. Like the Native American groups that both predated and lived alongside them, the prospectors looked to their surrounding environment for food, hunting one of the most beloved mountain creatures, the bighorn sheep. They were hunted, stockpiled, and often sold at trading posts. Bighorn sheep experienced a similar fate during the Klondike Gold Rush. The muscular animals were in high demand, and their meat was roasted over fires. Due to little oversight, the sheep were hunted to the point of near extinction. According to one report, stampeders hunted local game. What once was a seasonal hunt turned into a year-round activity. Moose, caribou, mountain goats, and other animals were all harvested. As people hunted, local animal populations disappeared. Anyone hunting had to travel farther to find game. For First Nation hunters, this meant altering traditions.
Yeah, I don't know that I don't know what a sheep would taste like. I've never had
chicken,
lamb, or sheep, so I don't know.
I don't know.
Not excited by that though.
No.
I want my meat animals to be ugly.
But if you're hungry,
I don't want to feel guilty.
Yes.
All right, and our last item is nettle soup.
Sounds dangerous.
Doesn't it already sound bad? Nettles were used by Native Americans in Northern California long before the gold rushes. They found the fibrous plant good not only for weaving fishing nets, but also for making soup. Okay, if the product can do both of those things, maybe one shouldn't be. All right.
And also give you a really good rash.
As nettle leaves are one of the first signs of growth to arrive after snow melts, collecting and cooking them became a common practice in the Gold Rush era. Nettles have a spinach or cabbage flavor when they're cooked, which make them a good alternative to greens that were unavailable to gold miners. The leaves were often mixed with starch to create a thicker consistency.
And there's supposed to be medicinal value in nettles too. So they're all over here in the Northwest, but they do leave you a little nice little rash too.
So I've never,
it's like poison ivy or poison. Okay. Yeah.
See, as a kid, I could like rub poison ivy on me and I wouldn't, nothing would happen. So
you want to test it again?
No, not particularly. So shall we take a quick little break?
That sounds good. We'll be right back.
September 13th, 1918. Ladies, darken your gray hair.
Use Grandma's sage and tea sulfur recipe and nobody will know. The use of sage and sulfur for restoring faded gray hair to its natural color dates back to grandmother's time. She used it to keep her hair beautifully dark, glossy, and attractive. Whenever her hair took on that dull, faded, or streaked appearance, this simple mixture was applied with wonderful effect. Ask for it at your drugstore. Wyeth's Sage and Sulfur Compound.
And welcome back to An Adventure in History. We're just wrapping up our evening. Thank you for joining us tonight.
So we've got a little bit of time, so we should do some local, this week in local history.
This week.
Let's see, September 27th, 1932, Henry F. Peacock, former assistant postmaster at Astoria, was sentenced to 4 years in the federal penitentiary when he entered a plea of guilty to a charge of appropriating approximately $8,700 of local post office funds to his own use. Peacock has a wife and 6 children and claimed he couldn't support his family on his $1,800 a year salary.
Well, obviously.
So let's just take 5 years worth of my salary out of the coffers.
Makes sense. September 28th, 1932, 11-year-old Reno Workala was in the Columbia Hospital recovering from serious burns received as a result of grasping hold of a high-tension wire. The incident happened when the young man climbed to the top of an old platform and grabbed a hold of the electric wire to keep from falling. Authorities stated it was a miracle the boy wasn't killed by the high power line.
Yikes.
Scary.
All right. September 29th, 1904. The cable that was laid across the river a few weeks ago from Fort Stevens to Fort Canby to connect with the Weather Bureau station at Northhead has been interrupted in its transmission of telegrams sent and is at least temporarily out of service, much to the detriment of all local shipping interests. I love that there's like a cable in 1904.
Yeah. And have you walked around Cape Disappointment? They have a lot of interpretive signs and information available about this particular, what they did out there.
It's kind of
the
one
Weather
of my,
Bureau. Yeah.
It's kind of one of my favorite places in our region.
Yeah.
And the museum is fantastic.
The museum,
I mean, they got state
yes.
funds, so hey, you can do anything with state money. But it's just a fun place, and the hike is nice, and the lighthouse. So yeah.
And they have the bunkers that are still there, so it's kind of a neat place to walk. September 30th, 1932, Vancouver, Washington. Two posses of nearly 20 peace officers and Northwest Federal Prohibition agents scoured the woods today for Louis Cousins, known moonshiner, who last night shot and killed Ballard Turner, Seattle Prohibition agent, and seriously wounded his partner. Cousins denies any part in the shooting, claiming he was in Portland all day.
It wasn't me. I was in Portland.
Yeah.
That's the way he said that, too, I bet.
Yeah.
All right. So this one's very important for everybody to listen to.
Okay.
October 1st, 1928. Bicycle stolen. Robert Williamson, 212 Harrison, reported to police yesterday that his bicycle was stolen while he was watching the football game at Giro Field Saturday afternoon. The bicycle was a Hawthorne Deluxe model with red and white framework. So if you see it, Robert would like his bicycle back.
1928. October 1st, 1932, unless a greater percentage of taxes are paid, the schools will be confronted by a crisis. With no special levy this year, the schools will entirely depend upon the willingness of the taxpayers to support the schools and avert a crisis. The budget board agreed. I always love the adjectives.
Yes.
Like, just say them over and over again.
The writers are just so much better than
they are
any of our writers in any forum today.
That sounds good.
All right. Well, this is fun. Go make some history and make some hardtack and tell me how it tastes. And we'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening. Go make some history.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.